January 9th, 1998, mid-afternoon. 6th Avenue, Avenue of the Americas. Same difference. Street with a split identity. Beginning in the late 1870s, an elevated train line rattled overhead from Greenwich Village to Central Park, creating a valley of depressed property values below. Then, in the early 30s, Rockefeller Center rolled up against the L from the east, and within a few years, the tracks were gone. In the mid-50s, you rode the bus up 6th, gazed with a kid's astonishment at the modern office slabs sprouting like huge dominoes on both sides of the avenue from the lower 40s north. Then came the medallions. Bright-colored insignias of every American nation hung from sleek, curved-topped lampposts along the whole length of the thoroughfare. The emblems looked fascinating. Very official, lots of detail, but impossible to examine properly from the street. You could read the country names, though, and sound them out. Uruguay, Paraguay, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, one by one as you walked to school up the avenue, from 3rd or Waverly to 12th Street. You didn't know it at the time, but the same Rockefellers whose name went with the center had been busy south of the border, too, sinking their teeth into a juicy melon called United Fruit, not to mention great suckings forth of Venezuelan oil. Over decades, exhaust fumes and the elements took their toll on the medallions. The enamel rusted around the edges, images faded, blending into the visual noise of the cityscape. But they disappeared for good only a few years back, when the lampposts were scrapped and new ones went up, sans insignias. By which time the city had pan-Americanized to the point where Johnny Colon, East Harlem native and salsa legend, could, with a wink, spin the Big Apple a new nickname, El Gran Mango. And mangoes come from Southeast Asia, too. At 59th Street, 6th Avenue turns into a tree-lined roadway, exchanging its linear flow for a serpentine drive northward into Central Park. Here, in a modest plaza carved out of the parkland, three bronze equestrian statues stand high atop black granite pedestals, larger than life. They depict heroic figures in the wars of America's independence, and the relationship among the triumvirate is formal, deliberate. San Martin faces east toward the old world he returned to. Bolivar rides purposely in the direction of Los Angeles. Martí looks as if he was about to leap over 59th Street south when his horse reared up, pawing the air. Taken by surprise, the apostle of his people reels back, frozen in disequilibrium. Afternoon flurries drift over packed down snow. You head east, then north toward Hunter College, stealing time from paying work to research the Trade Center book. Martí doesn't move. Why should he? He witnessed plenty, a New York even more spectacular than your own. Reported from the city of his exile on the opening of the Brooklyn Bridge, festivities for the Statue of Liberty, the great blizzard of 1888. You evolve the impossible notion that he sees you trudge by beneath him. You slip once on the glazed marble pavement. Then he urges you to go see Dr. Filenki about the occasional pains in your sternum. Filenki's a good guy. He treats patients on a sliding scale, but it's still more than you can afford just now. Every Xerox at the library costs a dime, same with every microfilm print. And anyway, it's not a classic heart symptom you're feeling. Stress or grief, more likely. A pigeon alights on Marti's right shoulder. Jose, did you know that today 2 million New Yorkers, citizens of that immense valve of pleasure open to an immense people, have no health insurance? But Marti, green and oxidizing, is not listening. And for the first time in all the years you've known this statue, you finally read it. It's not the taxis honking, the Lilliputian nags pulling buggies full of tourists that spooked Marti's horse. Marti is home, in Cuba, leading his column through the pass at Dos Rios, fixed in the moment of ambush, where the bullet found him.